to all. Hope everybody had a pleasant Shabbos. Right now it's about 11:13. We'll start in about 2 minutes. We'll deviate from Koheles today and we'll take up yesterday's Parsha Toldos, and we will start momentarily. Now we just start with a brief sound check, make sure that you're picking up the audio feed okay. Once you hear the audio stream, just type audio okay at the bottom of your screen. That'll confirm that the audio is being picked up properly. And again, we'll start just in about 1 or 2 minutes. Intermittently, we'll pause to see if there's any questions or comments that you want to share. If you do have any, you can just type them at the bottom of your screen, and we'll address them. All right, JHS, thanks a lot for that audio confirmation. Briefly, you know, we understand that Rebecca had a very troublesome pregnancy, and she had, according to Ibn Ezra, had inquired from the mothers in the area where she was living if what she was experiencing was the norm, and they told her that it wasn't normal what she was going through. So then she went to seek out a prophet. That's why it says that she went to go seek out God. That means that God's information would, could be revealed to her through a prophet. And it says either she went to Abraham or she went to Shem, the son of Noah. And the basic information that she received is that she'll have she's going to be giving birth to two nations, and that the older is going to serve the younger. And that was it. That was a very brief prophecy. Then we're also told, as we get through, even again, you have to keep in mind, and this is one of the principles we probably discussed before, but here it's just so much more, at least it impacted me so much more, because a lot of times you read a story and you just, take each or a number of verses just as giving you, you feel it's just like background information. But from here, it appears that every single verse is essential. I mean, that makes sense. And Maimonides actually says this in his Guide for Perplexed. That you shouldn't think that something is like a vain thing. And if it seems that way, so it's, he says that it seems that the person who has that claim is really the one that has a vain position. So it really pushes a Torah student to ask the questions, what is this verse all about? And what's that verse all about? What's the necessity for it? So first we're told that she, like we said, she had the troublesome pregnancy. How's the sound, by the way? Is it okay?
Yeah, it is. We're getting some electrical interference. I don't know if anybody else is hearing it, but we can hear you.
Okay. Okay, so it says after that that she gets a prophecy that the older will serve the younger. And then it says that her days of pregnancy became full, meaning they came to the ninth month, and she had twins. And the first one came out, and it was red. He was a very reddish color to his skin, completely covered with hair. And you actually have conditions like that today. There were people that the hair covers all parts of their bodies, even their face. I'm not sure if that was the case with Esav, but it says he was, at birth, covered with hair. So she called him Esav. Okay. And afterwards, his brother came out, and his hand was seizing his heel. That means Jacob, who came out next, his hand was on the heel of Esav. And that's what Akev or Yaakov, that means the same thing. So that's why it says in the verse, we're in 25:26. Therefore, his name was Jacob. And Yitzchak was 60 years old when she bore them. And the children grew, and Asa became one who knew how to hunt, a man of the field, and Jacob was a simpler man. Quanto unculus means he was complete, and he dwelt in tents. Then it tells us that Isaac loved Asa because he caught him with his mouth. Two views on that, either that he fooled his father to make himself look like he was really interested in studying God. Another is that he actually caught, he hunted with his mouth. And then it says, Rivka loved Jacob. Interesting, it does not say why she loved Jacob, but it does say why Isaac loved Esav. Alright, so that's important to note. Of course, also, I mean, about the hand on the heel. And that's what I'll get to in terms of being, I think, a new insight. Immediately afterwards, it tells us in verse 29 that Jacob was cooking a pot of lentils, and Esav came in from the field exhausted, and he told to Jacob, you know, give me some of this red lentils that you have, because I'm weary, I'm exhausted. And then it says, therefore his name is called Edom, which means red, because the food was red. So what is that telling us? And immediately Jacob responds and says that I'll be glad to give you the food in exchange for you selling me the birthright, because Esav did exit the womb first, so he was the firstborn, and Jacob wanted the birthright. So Esav says, I'm going to die, what is really to me this birthright? So Esav was making that to be nothing really of importance to him. So Jacob said to him, swear to me, and Esav complied, and he sold him birthright. And Yaakov gave him the food, bread. Okay, and that pretty much is the story. If we skip past the whole famine, we end up that all of a sudden Rivka hears that Isaac is getting older, and this is now the beginning of chapter 27. So Isaac is now getting older, and his eyes were weak from seeing, he couldn't see, and he told Esav to go hunt for him, so this way he would eat and have a good meal, and then he would bless Isaac with the blessings. And Rivka heard about this, so she told Jacob that they would have to conspire to fool Isaac, and you know, Jacob would go in, and he would dress up just in case his father would touch him, which you see did happen. And the mother, you know, Rivka says, go get the two kids, the two goats, and I'll make the food that your father likes, and I'll put the skins on your arms and on your necks. So this way, if he touches you, you'll feel like Esav, who's a very hairy person. And you see that it worked, he went in, and you see also that, let's see. Like, it just so happens that Rivka heard. I mean, if she didn't hear that Isaac was telling Esav to go get the foods, this way I'll eat and I'll feel good and I'll bless you. So if she didn't hear about this, so then Esav would have successfully received the birthright. And Rivka is asking, is it possible that Rivka loved Yaakov because he listened to her? No, it's a good question. I'll tell you what I think in terms of why she loved him. And why is that significant? But you see that Jacob is successful, and his father ate, and he gave him the blessings. Okay. You see, an interesting thing, it says, as soon as the blessings were complete, so no sooner, this is now verse 30, 27:30, and it was that when Isaac completed the blessing of Jacob, and it wasn't as soon as Jacob left from before his father Isaac, that Esav came from his capture, and he made the food like his father commanded him. So what does this show you? That the timing was perfect. What do you learn from that? You learn that God orchestrated this, that it should be successful. That God's providence was involved. Okay. And it's even said later on, too, that when Esav finds out that his brother took the birthright from him, he was very angry, and he shrieked very loud, and he begged his father three times, and his father finally gave him some blessing. But then it says, in 27:41, that Esav said in his heart, The days of my father's life, the days of his mourning are soon. Then I will kill Yaakov. I will kill Jacob afterwards. Okay. And Rivka is writing that Rivka had come from the house of deception, from the house of Lavan, and taught her two sons to follow Hashem. Esav did not follow, but Jacob did, so she loved Jacob. I think there's another reason why that the Torah tells you this, that she loved Jacob. But the fact is that it says in 42 that this sentiment that Esav said in his heart, how was it told over to Rivka? It says in 42 that it was told to Rivka the words of Esav, meaning that he was planning on killing Jacob because he took the birthright. So what's the only possibility?
She hear it from a prophet again?
Exactly. I mean, if it's a thought of a person, and Esav didn't share it with anyone, so it had to be prophetic. So you see again the proof that God is working with Rivka's plan. Okay, so that's pretty much the text that we want to take up, but what we have to do now is understand what are all these, there's so many facts. So why does she have a troublesome pregnancy to begin with? I mean, it's true that all the matriarchs are barren, but they did not have a troublesome pregnancy once they became pregnant. So you see that Rivka inquires from the other mothers first, is this normal or not? Evidently, this is her first pregnancy. And they tell her, according to Ibn Ezra, that it's not the norm. So she goes to inquire from a prophet. But you see, the rabbi said that she went either to Abraham or to Shem, the son of Noah. Who didn't she go to?
She didn't go to her husband.
Exactly. Why not? And, I mean, it would seem to be also, did she ever tell the prophecy to Isaac?
No, you don't get any indication she ever shared any of this with him.
Well, I think there's a proof that she never did. What's the proof in the text that we just read that she never told Isaac? Now remember, what was the prophecy? The prophecy was that the older was going to serve the younger. Now what's the proof that she never told this Isaac?
That he was going to give the blessing to the older?
That what?
That Isaac was prepared to give the blessing to the older?
Exactly.
He wouldn't have known the prophecy.
Exactly. Had she told Isaac the prophecy, then he would never plan to give it to Esav, right? Very good. So now you have to ask another question. So why didn't she tell Isaac this? As you answer one question, then you have to follow down that path in terms of the method, and that's okay, fine. We have a proof now that she didn't tell him. We see that she didn't go to him, according to the rabbis, in terms of understanding what the prophecy was, or to understand the unnatural nature of her pregnancy. So she understood that something more was going on here. Why she went to a prophet, we can say, because she understood that there was a providence, starting with Abraham, and that his descendants would be a great nation. And Rivka knew that she was right in line there, she was essential to this. So, with that knowledge, she went to seek out prophecy. And you could also ask, well, why wasn't prophecy given to Isaac? Why was this? This seems to be completely through Rivka, this whole thing. So why wasn't it told? Go ahead.
Rabbi?
Yeah, Cal. Hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm fine. I thought my understanding was that Isaac he didn't have the understanding and the background that she had been raised in with her background, she was much more wise about sort of the cunningness or people who are deceitful. Abraham had it, but Isaac didn't, and that she was very much, she knew her husband well, and she knew, for lack of a better word, she knew his sort of limitations in experience and understanding. And so she didn't go there. She went to seek counsel elsewhere.
Right. And somebody actually, I'm not sure if it was Rabbi Fox, I think it probably was, that you see that when Abraham was seeking a wife for Yitzchak, so Abraham found his own wife. So why didn't Yitzchak, or Isaac, why didn't Isaac go and seek his own wife? So I think Rabbi Fox wanted to say that it shows you that there was a inability in Isaac in order for a certain that you're saying, in order to really, in terms of the human relationships. So Abraham was more adept in terms of locating a certain character in a person, whereas Isaac was not. There was something that I don't know exactly what. I remember Rabbi Che talking about how the fact that Isaac was sacrificed his life, and certainly I think even the Ibn Ezra even says that it's true that Abraham had gone so far to attempt to kill his own son at God's will, but Isaac himself was a very high level because he went along with it. And that fact that he was able to give himself over and remove himself from this world stayed with him. And I believe that's what Rabbi Chait said, that's why it's a metaphor that says the reason why Isaac became blind is because the tears of the angels fell in his eyes when they saw this whole thing he was doing. So of course that's not literal. An angel is not physical, so it has no tears. But it means something about reality that Isaac appeared at that point. He raised himself to such a level that it means the angels, to show that there was a higher plane that he was on now because he devoted his life. So that changed him from that point forward. So it's like you're saying, Cal, correct. So you see that this couldn't have, so therefore this could not have worked. The plan, in terms of having the Jewish nation come about, it was essential that Rivka now be told something. But she would only be told something if she went to inquire. And for some reason the prophecy wouldn't just come straight through her, but it had to be in this way where it was concerning the pregnancy and made her focus on that being a primary issue. And then when she gets the information, so now what is she supposed to do with this information? So if you just get the prophecy, so why couldn't it be that she understood, but there was no call to action for her to do anything? Why did she feel that she now had to be instrumental over here and do something? Usually when you get a prophecy, so you can say, okay, now God's revealing to me certain things that will take place in the future. That doesn't mean that I have to be part of that, right? Isn't it plausible to say that when she understood the prophecy that the older is going to serve the younger, so she could just say, all right, God will do that. Right? Isn't that a plausible approach or response that she could have had?
Yeah, but God acts through people. And the fact that the prophecy was given to her seems to indicate that she's very instrumental in seeing through, that she has a responsibility in this to see through that it happens.
Well, I mean, I don't see why we have to say that because he gives the prophecy to her that now, he's not telling her to do anything. If the prophecy tells the person to do something, fine, so then they have to act. But if there's no instruction, I would say, so then there's no reason for the person to do anything.
But through the course of events, if it looks like the prophecy isn't being fulfilled,
right,
then she has the responsibility to step in.
Well, let's take, for example, Moses at the Red Sea. So, he knew that God would save the people. But he, well, let's see if that's a good example. I mean, God had told him in all those plagues and everything that he had to do something, whether it's stretching out a staff or going into to Paro. There was a command for him to do a certain act. He had to go down to Egypt. So it's true that God is working with man, but it's when he tells him to do something, that's when he has to act. Here it was purely the younger is going, the older is going to serve the younger. But you see, there's one more element in the story here. What happened when they were being born? What was the very unique event that took place?
The heel.
The heel. Now, what is it telling us this for? See, I'm going to suggest, I don't have a proof, but it could be like this, that without that, without her seeing the hand of Jacob on the heel of Esav, so maybe she wouldn't have done anything. She would have just heard the prophecy, and then she would have let God work it out as he can do. He doesn't need her to do anything. Right? Even when Moses was going down to Egypt at God's command, and there was a delay in terms of doing the circumcision, when he first, set up camp in the inn, so then God, it says, Ve'evake Shemiso, God sought to kill Moses because there was a grave sin that took place over there. And Rabbi Chait said on that point, you see that man is man is dispensable. Even Moses, God doesn't need him. He can achieve the Exodus by a number of ways. So we can't feel that it's necessary, that any individual is necessary. What was his point over there? But here, Rivka saw something. She heard the prophecy, but then she saw the hand on the heel. What did that show her? Let's explore that for a second.
Maybe that it's going to take some action on Jacob's part.
Good. Meaning, she was being shown a certain aspect of the nature of Jacob. That's what I believe is going on over here. This is what it occurred to me, during Shabbos, we were discussing it in shul. And perhaps without that, then she would not have acted. But now she understood that very strange event of him grabbing onto the heel of his brother was necessary to show her something, that not only is there a prophecy that the older is going to serve the younger, but now the way it's going to unfold is through a certain character of Jacob. Now you see, do you see what I'm saying? You follow what I'm saying that? Because you could just be told a prophecy, you don't need to have anything else if you're just being told information. But if you're being requested to act, so now it's an interesting type of a formula. Because normally God tells Moses, this is what you must do. He verbally tells him. I mean, not verbally, but in terms of the command is there, it's communicated. Here, you could say that the fact that there was another event happening, aside from the prophecy itself, now there was something further that she was gleaning from that. That was intended. Now, just give me one moment. I just want to think about one thing. Interesting. I was thinking out loud that, and Rivka's saying it was a proof to her, a solid indication of the prophecy. Well, no. The prophecy she was sure about. there was no doubt about the prophecy itself. She didn't need to see anything in the physical world because she understood prophecy is from God. It's true. But perhaps it was telling her the very nature of how the servitude of the older will take place. I mean, it'll be through an act of, see, the heel means Akev. And you see that even Esav said to his father after he found out that you know, that Jacob took the firstborn, he says, Yagveni is Shnei Pomim. He says, he uses the word Jacob in Hebrew, which is Yaakov, or Akev, which is the heel, and that's why he got the name. And Esav hears this, and he says, yeah, it's in 27:36. And when Esav hears this, and he's distraught. So first of all, it's interesting that in 27:35, so Jacob says to Esav, "Your brother has come with wisdom, and has taken your firstborn, your birthright." Why does he say this to Esav? Perhaps he's trying, now that he understands that if he was able to actually utter the blessings to Jacob, not knowing it was him, Isaac understood that this must have been through God. This was divinely planned. And therefore he must be blessed. Because if God allowed me to utter the blessings, therefore it must have been God's will. And if it's God's will, so that means Jacob is rightfully possesses them. Therefore, what does he say to Esav? Now, that's why it says that in 27:33, that when Isaac found out that it wasn't Esav that he blessed, it was somebody else, it says that he trembled. He had a great fear. Why did he have a great fear? He had a great fear because he realized that he misjudged his son Esav. And if they couldn't go to him, if the blessings couldn't go to him, that means he must have been unworthy. Now that he knew that he was unworthy, so therefore he says, chapter 27:35, he says, your brother came with wisdom. Why is he saying this? Because he's trying to now bring Esav back to the right life. He's trying to underscore what was so, that Jacob had a good quality, and you should aspire to this, Esav. He's praising him, in other words. So he's not just explaining the events. This is another verse that has to be explained. Why does this verse in the Torah? We have to ask ourselves that question. It's not just giving us a recount of history. It's telling us all the crucial elements. And what I believe when Isaac is saying this to Esav is because now that he understands that Esav missed the mark, he's trying to point them towards what is good. And this is your brother, and he possesses wisdom. So look at that, Esav. I know Esav responds, and he says that therefore his name is fitting that it's Yaakov. Because v'yakveni, that he has usurped me. Right, these two times he took my first my birthright, and now he has taken the blessings. Two things. So you see that the name Jacob, which the heel or overtaking, you're grabbing one by the heel. So, perhaps that's exactly what happened when Rivka had not only received the prophecy, but she also saw him grab onto the heel. Number one, it shows that Jacob had that ability to confront and oppose Esav. So that was one thing she was being shown. But perhaps also it was showing her how it would take place, that it would be in an act of overtaking him. And that's when she realized, when the blessings were about to be given to Esav, now she realized this is really what that prophecy was all about. This is really what the hand on the heel meant to me. It means that there has to be a point where Jacob will now overtake Esav. And this is right where it is in terms of the blessings. So maybe that's why she needed that as well, to show her how. So instead of being communicated normally, like by Moses, so he's just told by God, this is what you have to do. He's given a prophecy numerous times to do things. But by Rivka, the fact was told to her that the older would serve the younger, but then the method and the capability in Jacob's nature was shown through a very simple act of Jacob's hand clutching the heel of Esav. And I actually saw two things, that Jacob had this ability to do it, and that the way the actual usurping of Esav would be when there's a moment in time where the blessings will go either one way or the other. Meaning that's the pivotal point in terms of who's going to serve who. So that's what the hand on the heel shows. It was additional information, not just, you know, showing a very simple thing, but that's necessary. All right, you see what I'm saying?
Rabbi?
Yes, Cal.
I've always had a question about that whole situation with Yaakov making up the red stew or the meal or the food that he was preparing, and Esav selling the birthright to him because he was hungry. Why didn't Yaakov make that known to anybody? I mean, that seems like something really significant, but it was never made known. I mean, he never told his mother, he never told his father. What did he expect to come about as a result of that?
Well, I believe what really took place is another point over there. That I believe that once Rebecca had the prophecy, and she knew that now it would be, that Jacob would be the leader. See, that's why he also says in the beginning, why does it say that Isaac loved Esav and Rivka loved Jacob? I mean, this is not a storybook again, so we have to ask on that too. So I believe that, I think this one idea travels through all the questions that we have. The Torah is telling us this because now that she understood the prophecy, it wasn't a maternal love for a child. You're talking about the people that were prophets and prophetesses. So when the Torah was recording that she loved Jacob, it was because she loved God and God's will. And once she knew that it was going to be through Jacob, now the Torah is telling us that she focused on Jacob and wanted to make sure that she carried out God's plan. That's what it means that she loved Jacob. And I believe that because she knew the prophecy, see, how come Jacob was so quick to ask for the birthright? He's sitting at home, he's cooking a meal, whatever. Esav comes in exhausted from the field, and it seems like right away, on the tip of his tongue, Jacob has a response. Yeah, I'll give you some of the food, give me your birthright. But I believe it's because Rivka had told him long ago. She confided in Jacob and told him what the prophecy was, and that you now have to always be ever prepared and use your cunning and figure out when's the right moment. That's why he bought it. Otherwise, what right do you have to buy the birthright from your brother? Where do you even get the knowledge that you can purchase a birthright? I mean, that would be an odd thing. But I believe it's because what the Torah is not telling us. So the Torah tells you what's minimally needed in order to understand. Then you have to dig in and start asking the questions. And that's where I believe the real the ideas come from. So I would say that he was told by Rivka about this whole prophecy. And she didn't share it with Isaac because, you see, like Josh said, he still intended on giving the blessings to the older. If he knew the prophecy, he would have given it to the younger one. So, now your question, Cal, is specific as what?
I guess my question is, what then is the purpose of that whole incident with Jacob, you know, asking him, well, I'll give you this if you will give me the birthright? Is it to give us more information about the character of Esav, that he would just give it over him just because he was hungry? Or is there something more to that?
I thought about that too. It's a good question. I thought perhaps that he had to get the birthright justly, so it had to be purchased. Meaning it did have monetary value in terms of what his father would bless him with. So in order to justly own it, it's true that there is a prophecy, but he still had to step in and do something in terms of a monetary acquisition of it. But he waited. He waited for the right moment, and he saw this is really, he had the leverage, he had the upper hand right now, and he that's why he purchased it. So just to go in and steal it would have been, it seems to be, would have been wrong. It seems to be that he had to purchase it, otherwise it would have been unjust to go in and just fool his father.
Every time I've read this part, that part of the story, it always made me feel like Esau was approaching it with, yeah, that's fine, let me go feed my stomach and then I'll deal with that later, like he could always get it back again, or that it wasn't really valid.
Yeah, he said that openly. You're right. He said, what do I need this? I mean, I'm going to die, and then what do I need? What did he say? He says in the beginning of the story, that's in 25:32. And Esau said, behold, I'm going to die, and therefore what do I need his birthright? Doesn't mean he's going to die right now. That could mean, see, why was he so tired that day? So when he, why was he exhausted? So rabbis say that that day he committed idolatry and adultery and he murdered. Because on that day, Abraham died. And when Rabbi Chait explained very well that when Esav saw his grandfather die, so this old man, Esav had this immortality fantasy. And now he sees this old man actually dies. Of course, people die all the time, but you know, persons inner workings have a very good, you know, very capable ability of denying. Everybody else dies, but not me. But this now struck a chord very close to home, and he was living a righteous life, and therefore he said, "What is it worth anymore?" That's why he went out and he completely rebelled, and he did the three cardinal sins that day. I don't know if that means it literally, but it means that he completely abandoned the path that Abraham was teaching. Okay. And JHS, you're asking that the word guile is the meaning. I guess you mean that where he took it with wisdom, right? Yeah. It means with wisdom. If you look at Unculus, Unculus says that when he took it, I'm just answering a JHS. He's asking a question online. He says the word guile is used in 27:35. That when Isaac says to Esau that your brother came and took the birthright with guile, it really wasn't guile. It was wisdom, is how Unculus translates it. Okay. All right. So, yeah, somebody had a question?
Yeah, dog. When you indicated that Rabbi Chait said he went out that day and committed adultery. Is adultery, I mean, I thought adultery was only defined in terms of a woman.
Yes.
So that it would be technological or technically impossible for a man to commit adultery.
Well, if she was married to somebody else, that would be adultery.
So that if he has relations with someone who's married to somebody else, she commits adultery, does he also?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. I tried to actually locate that. I thought it was Rashi. I just didn't. Let me see.
I thought adultery was defined as a married woman having relations with someone who was not her husband.
Yes, that's exactly right. But I believe both parties, both parties, I believe, are killed. I mean, they're both committing the same crime. Right?
Well, that's the question. I somehow thought that a man having relations with someone who was not his wife was not adultery.
So according to you, how could a man ever commit adultery?
That's the question.
No, I think that's the case. That it doesn't matter whether he's married or not. It matters that they both are not respecting the institution of marriage that she is part of. So he is equal to her. So now we understand why Jacob was very ready to buy this, because according to what I'm suggesting, he was told by Rivka about this prophecy. And you see also another proof to this. What was the whole reason that they didn't just go straight to Isaac and tell him, listen, he bought it, it's his, and you should just bless Jacob. But they had to do it deceit. They had to actually lie. So evidently, like...
Rabbi, is it possible that they did tell Isaac? Because, okay, in 2736, Isaac says to Esau, your brother came with wisdom and took your blessing. And then he says, because his name's Yaakov,
Yeah, you have to speak a little bit louder. I can't hear you.
Okay. Esau says, when he took away my birthright, and see now he took away my blessing. It's almost like Isaac already knew about the first time that he took away his birthright.
No, why would you say that?
Just because of the way he says it.
He seems to be
outwitting me times. He took away my birthright, and see, now he took away my blessing.
Yeah, that's news. Both of those are two elements that are news.
Those are news?
Yeah, they're both news to Isaac.
Okay.
Yeah, but you see then, when Rivka goes to Jacob and says, listen, I heard your father's going to bless Esav, and now this is the plan we have to use to deceive him. So, he doesn't respond as if that's news to him. Meaning, Jacob doesn't respond to his mother as news, which would indicate, he just says, well, I may get caught, I may get found out. So that sounds like a response of somebody who knew all along. Again, supporting what I'm suggesting, that she told Jacob. Which makes sense, that it would be better if it was premeditated, if she really wanted to help fulfill the prophecy, so that he should be told younger, he should always be ready, it should be something which is already in his mind, and his mind accepts it. If she just stuns him later on in life, and says, by the way, I had this prophecy, and now you have to steal it from your father. You have to get the birthright from your father, and not so your brother doesn't get it. There might have been some hesitation over there. But you see, there was no hesitation. And there was no hesitation to lie, either. He understood that he had to do something now, because he knew about the prophecy. His only concern was that I might get caught. Meaning to say that both Rivka and Jacob knew that this had to be done. And that lying is okay in this situation. Ibn Ezra actually says that. He quotes many cases from the Torah where people lied. You see even one case where when King Saul had not followed God, so he didn't kill the king of Amalek, Agag. So then God sends a message through the prophet Samuel, and he says to Samuel, you tell Saul that you didn't listen to me, and now I've despised you for being king, and I'm going to get somebody who's better than you. So now God tells Samuel, go ahead to the house of Jesse, and I will tell you who's going to be the one that you'll anoint. So Samuel says to God, but if Saul hears about this, he'll kill me. So God tells to Samuel, so take some animals with you, and you'll say that you're offering a sacrifice. Which clearly is that it's misleading, it's a lie. But even God is telling him in this situation, this is what you must do. So you see, the lie is something which is at times necessary. We don't have this absolute idea that you can never lie. I mean, if a person is going to kill you and you can save yourself by lying, you lie. You lie through your teeth. Okay. But you see how the story unfolds, how the information had to be given to her, and it also required her to act, and it was something that she understood, that if it came to her, maybe she also understood that the fact that she got the prophecy and didn't go to Isaac, that was an indication that it should not be told to Isaac. And so here's another point that I didn't even think about. I'm just thinking out loud now. That perhaps the very design of the fact that it was communicated to her means to say that it was not to Isaac for a reason. So she didn't tell him. And again, with the hand on the heel, meaning that was necessary in order to see the nature of Jacob, that she knew that she would now help this prophecy unfold by working with the nature of her two sons. That's another lesson. And the fact it's going to be the specific thing of a hand on a heel, so that means that that she's being told that it's going to be through an event where one, the youngest, can usurp the older. So where was that event? That was the blessings. That was the primary act of one usurping the other. Because that's where you're getting the right now, you're getting the blessings from God. There could be no greater act of usurping somebody else if it's through God himself. So you see, even the design of these events was to teach certain points. I mean, it is very interesting, if what I'm saying is true. Again, it's I didn't see real support for it, but I don't see anything contradicting it, and I think also of the design. And we do see proof for a lot of this, the fact that she didn't tell Isaac, and that Jacob was ready to purchase this birthright very quickly, like it was premeditated.
Rabbi?
Yes, God.
Wondering if I was mixing two separate things. Is there anything in Torah that identifies the heel, you know, like the Achilles heel, as a sign, as an area of weakness? Because I was thinking that with this identification with the heel thing, is it that Yaakov took the birthright through Esau's weakness, in the sense that Esau was attached to the physical world and the physical pleasures, and so as through that, Yaakov was able to dominate his brother.
That's a nice idea, and there is support that the heel is the weak part by Genesis, by the snake. So God says to the snake after the Eve gets Adam to eat, so he punishes them all, and he tells the snake, he says that man will crush your head, meaning there's going to be there's a relationship between man and the snake. Man could overpower the snake by who Yishub Kharosh says that he will crush your head. That's how the man could overcome the snake. We are taught to Shepeno, okay, but it says you, the snake, you will get man by the heel. All right, that is, I'll show you. Okay, that is Genesis 3:15. So Sforno has an interesting explanation on this. He takes the snake as being non. Not literal, but whether Rashi explained this to be that the snake was real, and you made a good point, because it says if you say that the snake is a metaphor, well, what's to stop you from saying that Adam and Eve were also a metaphor? So unless you can't explain something, there's a rule I think you laid down, that if you can't explain something literally, then you explain it metaphorically. Like, for example, where it says that Jacob was left alone, and then he wrestled with a man. In one verse, it says that. So, that's impossible. If you're left alone, there's nobody else there. And if you're left alone, and then you wrestle with a man, so there can't be a literal explanation. That's an impossibility. But you can have an animal that has a certain level of intelligence, that's not impossible. You see that human beings have intelligence. So that's not an impossibility. So Rabbi Shea explained that the snake was really literal. But there could also be other messages too. Even taking the snake literal, it could be that there's also an idea to be derived, which I think is true, that if you look at a lesson about the instincts, so when man is battling the instincts, so he can crush them at the head, but Meaning, if we say the instincts of the snake, so man can crush the instincts at the head. That's what this verse says in 3:15, Genesis. But God says to the snake, "But you will get him at the heel." So you can explain it like this: that if man attacks the emotions, his instincts at the beginning of the battle, like if a person feels a certain emotional pull on something. There's something that's pulling them, a lust, a drive, revenge, whatever it is. If he attacks it right at the beginning, that he senses the feeling swelling up inside of him, man will be successful. That's crushing the snake at the head. But if he allows the instincts to swell even more, and he goes with it, and he doesn't fight them, so then it will overtake him at the end, at the heel. Then the instincts will be successful at the end of the battle, because then they'll overcome him. They're only too powerful for him. So the only way for man to really deal with the instincts is to always address them initially as he senses them and starting to swell up inside of him. So like you're saying, heel over here, you see the word? The last word in 3:15 is Akev. The same name as over here is Yaakov. Okay. Right, so let me just pause here and see if there's any questions or comments.
Are you saying that could be an indication as far as with Jacob and Esau that by him grabbing his heel that he would overtake him at the end?
Yes, an indication that if man does not battle his instincts and control them at the beginning of a certain part of the day, he may start feeling a certain instinct for something. If he doesn't deal with it head on, so then, and he lets it go, so then at the end of that struggle, since man didn't put up a fight, the instincts will get him and it'll make him sin. So that's what it means, that the snake will get man at the heel. The heel of the battle, the end of the battle.
Alright, I'm saying if you take it, if you took the same symbolism over to the Jacob and Esau story, I mean, would that have been perhaps an indication to that it was at the end, so to speak, here, at this end final point where Jacob would overtake Esau?
Yeah.
Possibly.
At the final point? I don't see that here. Where's the final point here?
When the blessings are about to be,
I don't see it as, I don't see the final aspect that you're pointing at, though.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I was asking.
Yeah, I think here it's because of the grabbing on the heel shows that's where you cause somebody to fall. You grab a person by the heel. You grab a person by the arm, it's not really showing that you're controlling his footing. You grab a person by the heel, that's usurping the person from being able to stand. That's what I just think it means over here. But it is intriguing that it's a unique type of prophecy that some information is given about the role. That's what's communicated to her verbally from the prophet. But in terms of other information, that's communicated through a visual of her seeing the one son grabbing the other son's heel. You do have another case where you had, I think, the children of Tamar, if I remember, was it Tamar? Yeah, I think Tamar, where one stuck his hand out first. She also had twins. So one hand came out first, so she tied a string around it to determine this one really breached the womb first. Then his hand went back in, and then the other brother came out first. Then I think the one with the string came out second. You see there was also something going on. See, but you see that I mean, it'd be worthwhile to investigate that. Let's see who that is. Thank you. Yeah, this is in Bereshit, Genesis 38:28. So 27 actually says, and it was that when she was giving birth, she had twins. And verse 28 says, and it wasn't when she gave birth, v'yitein yad, and a hand came out. So the birth, the midwife tied a string, like a scarlet string on his hand, and she said, this one came out first. And it was that he pulled his hand back into the womb, and then his brother came out. So that's worth looking at. What is going on over there? Similar, right? Something strange happens at birth. Because really, the head should come out first. We show that the hand came out first, so they must have understood that something's going on, that he may not come all the way out. So let's just indicate who really breached the womb first.
Rabbi, as an aside, Cal was wondering if that's in any way related to the whole red thread thing that has popped up. And I guess the secondary question that I would have is, if the Torah has no unnecessary words, why would it say red thread? Why not just a thread? Why would the color be significant?
Right. Well, to answer your first question first, I mean, the source that the Talmud gets, that the red string is prohibited, is a Tosefta, which is like the Mishnah. It's the end of the seventh chapter of the tractate Sabbath, and it talks about different things that are heathen practices from other nations, and one of them is putting a red string on your finger. So that's the place where we get it from. It's not from here. Here they weren't doing anything. Here was merely they put a string on to indicate who really was the firstborn.
Right.
Why red? I don't know. It is a good question. Why does it have to tell us over here that she put a red string? Let's see if anybody says anything on this. Shani. Sure. I don't know. Look around. See if you can find something out. I'll take a look.
Okay.
But I think that just to review those, to recap what we discussed today, you see that, I mean, to do this was just a really novel, new insights over here. And just from a simple question, you know, something I've read for so many years and just never asked the question, like, why have a troublesome pregnancy? And then just from one question, it just opens up more and more questions and more doors, and then you start seeing a pattern emerge. And it's just that's a very, very amazing thing, how we appreciate the way the Torah is written and how everything is not just laid out as a factual thing, because there is when the mind is caught in these questions, that's really how a person captivated into the learning. And then what he sees how these actual questions are actually the keys to the answers. That's just a, it's just an amazing thing. And so much is resolved. So you really learn the ingenuity of Rivka. And all, you know, the other principles as well, not just to the story, but in general you learn that lying is something which has to be done at times. And that God also doesn't just give the prophetess the straight information, but you have to work with it. God wants the person to engage their mind, and now you have certain information, Rivka, and now you see a certain act of a hand on a heel. Now what do you do with this? What do you derive from that? I mean, one thing you see is that the prophecy is being told to her about what's going to happen, that the older is going to serve the younger, but then that's only in terms of, you know, that's in the world of ideas. She's communicated an idea by God through the prophet. But then the fact that she has to see something in the physical world that's strange, then she realizes that that's now a message regarding her involved in the physical world. Just to try to clarify what I'm, you know, trying to say with that. I'm sure there'll be more to, you know, there's more on this. But it is an interesting type of a method of a two-part communication. Something interesting Rabbi Chait said, which I associate to this, it says that after, you know, Jacob had the 12 tribes and he left, and then, you know, Laban's chasing after him, and he wants to destroy them. He was really crazy. Some lunacy really seized him at that point. So God comes to Laban in a dream in the night and tells him, don't speak good or bad to Jacob. So the next day, Laban comes and tells this to Jacob. So Jacob hears Laban say that God told me not to speak good or bad to you. And this struck, and this I'm just quoting Rabbi Chait. Jacob was struck by this, and he knew that this was really prophetic, because sometimes a person will have a dream that God speaks to him, but that's just a person's own egomania. He feels he's worthy that God talk to him, but it's his own dream. God never really spoke to him. But if that was the case, Jacob said to himself, that if Laban really had a certain sense of guilt or whatever, because he was going after somebody who really followed God, meaning Jacob, so then the only thing that Laban would have heard in his dream is what? If he was really happy, he felt guilty that night about chasing after Jacob to kill him and the whole family, and he had a dream that he made of himself about God speaking to him, what would he have dreamt about?
He probably would have dreamt just not to hurt them, but he wouldn't have dreamt not to say anything good or bad.
Exactly. Very good. You got that quick. Exactly. Yeah, I remember when I heard Rabbi Chait said that, I said, wow, that is a great insight. You know, I was just very impressed with Rabbi Chait being able to pull that out of there. But you see that Jacob saw that, and he says, if it was really, like you're saying, exactly, Doug. He says, since he said to me, since Laban says to me that he had a dream and God told him not to speak good or bad, this had to be through God. And God is now saving my life right now. So they parted ways, and Laban was fearing God, and he didn't do anything to him. And he kissed his grandchildren, whatever, and he went back. And right after that, Jacob says that he saw the angel of God, and he called the place two camps. That's the very last verses, I think in Vayetzeh. Let me see. Yeah, the very last verse, it's Genesis 32, 3. So it's 32, verse 3. And actually says right before this, it says, if you look at the right beginning of chapter 32, it says that Laban got up in the morning, he kissed all of his children and his daughters, and he blessed them, and he went, and he returned back to his place. And then Jacob went on his way, and then he met the angels of God. And Jacob said when he saw them, he saw this camp of God, so he called the place Two Camps. What do you mean he saw them, he called Two Camps? So Rabbi Chay explained very nicely that he, you know, Jacob had all this cunning, and he had to keep on fighting back Laban. Every single time he changed his wages, 100 times, Rashi says, that Laban kept on changing Jacob's wages. Whenever Laban saw a certain flock was increasing, he said, that's now going to be my wages, and you get this smaller one. So it kept on, God kept on giving Jacob whatever Laban gave him, Jacob's flock would now increase. And Jacob had to really be very cunning and work things out and peel off the bark of the wood and use that to try to, you know, populate his flock. So he was using his cunning. But here he was now told a new thing. When Laban told him that God came to me and said, don't speak good or bad, and now Jacob knew it was not his own fantasy, but his own fantasy would have only told him, don't do anything bad. But now that he knows that Laban said that I had a dream and your God told me don't do good or bad, so now Jacob knew God did speak to him. And now Jacob says there are two camps going on, meaning there's my camp, my abilities, but I could not be successful without God's abilities. And I see that here now, that God came in and prevented Laban from killing me. So that's why he called it two camps. Meaning that's what it means he saw the angels of God. He saw God's hand at work. That's what it means that he approached, after Laban left, now Jacob fully grasped and saw what was at work all these years, all this time. There was his own camp, meaning his own abilities of trying to work back and use, to win out over Laban. But then there was God. So that's why he called this place two camps. There were two camps at work in order to bring me to the place where I was successful and I'm alive and I was prosperous. It was God's and my own doings, two different areas of involvement. So you see also, I just bring it up because you see that how an event came up and Jacob was able to have with his great insight, he was able to understand that the prophecy was given to him and also not just to stop Laban, but to communicate to Jacob something. So Jacob can fully appreciate God's hand in the whole matter. So there's so much to glean. You think these narratives, but like Maimonides says, every single verse, there's something to be learned. And not necessarily just one thing either. You see that idea, this last idea from Rabbi Chait?
Yes, thank you. Very interesting.
Yeah. All right, any questions?
I do have a question back to the blessings. It says Isaac knew that, after he'd given the blessing to Jacob, he knew that it was right because that God had allowed him to do it.
Correct.
Correct?
Yes.
Does that mean that, say that nobody had done anything and Esau had went in, then would Isaac not have been able to utter the blessings?
It seems that way. It seems from what we're saying that since he had some sort of understanding, I don't know how, but it seems to be Isaac had the opinion that if I was able to verbalize the blessings, then they had to go to the right one. But I'm not sure what would have happened had this not occurred, had Rivka not heard about the fact that Isaac was about to bless. I mean, you see that it was necessary for her to be part of it too. God's plan was that her and Jacob play a role. Not just that they are passive, and that God will work it out somehow. That's what the prophecy teaches you also, another idea. It's good that you're asking the question, Josh, because another idea presents itself now, and that is that it was essential in God's plan that both Rivka and Isaac do something. I don't know yet what the reason is. Why they had to. But you see, that was necessary. And had they not acted, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess it's hard to say what would have happened if. Huh?
Yeah, I don't know what would have transpired had she not acted. But it definitely lays the groundwork now with this approach. I mean, to me, this not only clears up this area, but it answers questions that I never even had before. But then, you know, the questions come up when they see it. But now, it gives a renewed, to me, it gives a renewed interest in really being this meticulous in the next area that we'd study. And then we see how this was orchestrated so cleverly, and how much there is below the surface, then we have to really dig for it. So we should, you know, retain this lesson and, you know, extract it from this area and then apply it whenever we open up the Torah again and we go through another area, is to have the sensitivity and the conviction of how much there is below the surface here and to where to look for the questions and to have this, you know, not to be satisfied with simplistic explanations. And not to look at things as just mere narratives and stories, just background information. But all truth, I mean, Maimonides does say sometimes you have a lot of verses and there's a new idea in every single verse, which is clearly the case here. But then he says sometimes you have a case, like I think it's in chapter 7 of Proverbs, where he talks about the woman who's a harlot. And it's just giving a lot of information just to paint.
Please note that your conference will expire in 10 minutes.
So Maimonides says in those cases, you could just have a lot of verses just to paint an image, just to give a backdrop. So really, I guess it takes a certain sensitivity to determine when, you know, each verse is really teaching something new, and when it's really just a bunch of verses that are there just to give you certain context. So you have to keep that in mind as well. And I believe he also says that, I think it's in the beginning of the guide that he talks about this, and I think he says also, if a person will try to look for reasons for every single verse in that latter case, so then he's just going to do himself an injustice, because those numerous verses are just there to give a background. So I guess as we progress and we study more, we'll start becoming more aware, hopefully, as to when to make the decision. When is every verse essential? And when is it that it's just a group of verses to give us, you know, context? So that we'll just have to approach on a case-by-case scenario. All right. Any other questions?
Rabbi, just one unrelated. Did you see the email from Naomi about candle lighting, and are you able to respond to that?
Oh, well, no, I didn't see it. What was the question?
Oh, her question was, shall we light a candle in memory of the rabbi and the Rabbitson who died in Mumbai and pray for them? They're obviously very, from the email, very, very hurt and troubled by that, and so I didn't know about candle lighting in a situation like that or not.
I don't know. I don't. I know that people light the candles on the yurt site, but to light a candle when somebody dies, I never heard of that before. I wouldn't do it.
Okay.
I mean, again, you know, we have to keep in mind that when, you know, events like that happen, the reason why a lot of people are bothered by it is because they're assessing the value of a person just in this world. And they don't realize that God has many ways to reward a person who's righteous. And we actually were discussing it yesterday. Somebody, I think it was Quoted Rabbi Chait, that said that a person can even be perfected after death, which would imply that's what the punishment is. When a person dies and they go through punishments, so then that there is a certain purification that the soul receives. In terms of, I mean, a tragedy, you know, a person, we can't judge people. I mean, that's basically God's area, not ours. And we have to be able to say, I mean, I heard of cases where, you know, very nice rabbis who I knew personally, and they would lose somebody when they're, you know, a daughter in her teens. And so you can't answer that. You don't know what God's equation is or what does he do, you know, after the person is gone. But the truth is the best existence is after this life. So if a person who has passed away is really in a better state. It's us who is going through the problem because we don't have an understanding of the justice, and also we're in pain because we missed the person. And certainly the people were out there and they were trying to educate people on Judaism. So, you know, we just have to recognize we don't have the answer. But we know that God is completely just, and that we see that the whole Torah teaches about the justice and how he related to different people based on, there was a story that talked about, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. They were friends of Daniel, and they were thrown into the fire with Daniel, and they came out, and the fire didn't touch them at all. There wasn't even a hair on their head. They were singed. There was no smell of smoke, nothing. Another righteous person was thrown into the fire. He came out, and there was a smell of smoke in his clothing. So the rabbis say because he wasn't totally righteous. He was worthy of being saved by a miracle from the fire, but I believe he had sons that weren't good, so there was a certain flaw that was shown that he was not completely unsinged. The fire had some effect on him. If he was completely righteous like Daniel's three friends, so then there would be no harm at all. No, not even a sense of smoke in their clothing. Not a hair on their head was singed. So you see that God works with exact justice. We just don't know it. We just don't know how to assess it. But the stories in the Chumash, I mean, Moses being saved, and the Jews being saved, and so on and so forth. I mean, and Jacob needed, I mean, Joseph needed certain...
Please note that your conference will expire in 5 minutes.
But Joseph needed certain perfections. There's a certain amount of egomania. So he was in prison for 2 years and additional, because he was confiding in himself that he thought that he was able to. He told the wine steward and the baker, you know, the interpretation of the dreams, and he said to please. He was relying on his own ability, and that's where he said, "Please get me out of the prison." And Rabbi Chaya explained there how. I think it was Rashi, actually, though, says that he needed 2 more years in prison after that because of that. He still needed to be perfected. I'm just showing you that if you look at all the stories, you see that there's an exact justice being meted out. So if the stories tell us, you know, we have Chumash, we have the Torah, so then we have clues to the answer. Here we don't. We don't know what to say in the case, so we don't speak. So we should definitely be convinced that nothing is beyond God's control, and he only works with exact justice. And we say the Nashrei every day. Tzadik Hashem b'chol derecha v'chaseh b'chol maaseh, that God is just in all of his actions. Nothing is outside of his control.
And is it also true, though, that we can get caught up in the laws of nature and... a righteous person is not necessarily guaranteed to be saved in the event of a natural or man-made disaster?
No, if a person is 100% righteous, he will be saved. Only a person, the Gemara says, only a person is killed or is harmed because of his sins. That's the only reason why. However, a person like Moses, where he... it says that he was a person has to die at a certain point. That's just because of the perfection that death brings to a person, not because a person sinned. The Midrash talks about 4 people who never sinned, but they still died also. So that's one thing. The person definitely has to die, but that was because of the new design that man needed from Eden. But a person is completely righteous and it's not his time to die, so God will save him. It says in the King David says, 7 bad things will befall the righteous person, but God saves him from every one. So that means that people have free will. So the onslaught of tragedies may commence. I mean, that's what it means, 7 bad things will befall. But it won't hurt him. God will, swoop him out of the harm's way.
He doesn't stop people from acting evil. People have free will. That's God's will also. The people should have free will. But he won't allow the completely righteous person to be harmed.
So does that suggest that there were no completely righteous people amongst the 6 million who died in the Holocaust?
You'd have to say that. You'd have to say that there are plenty of people that also didn't get killed in the Holocaust. But you can't say that God is not just. He's not going to kill somebody. He's not, step in. I mean, again, that's a whole study. What levels the people are at. But it doesn't make sense to me that, a person who's without sin, without flaw, that God would give any punishment. That's against what everything we learn. And it's just mind-boggling to us because we just can't assess how, every single one of those 6 million, I mean, that's just hard for us. We're humans.
We're going to lose our line here in just a couple of seconds, I think.
All right, so we'll pick up next week then.
Okay, thank you so much, Rabbi.
Okay, have a good day, everybody. A good week.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, that'll wrap it up for today. We'll continue next week, same time at 11:15, and a good week to everybody. Mm-hmm.